Hello, Zero Books viewers and readers. It's Pop the Left with Derek Varn and, of course, me, Douglas Lane. It's the year-end review. We're going to be wandering through the year, which was, I think, fairly eventful. And we'll also be talking about the curious case of Mark Christian Miller in this podcast stream and also in the Parrot Room. But Derek, welcome, and here we go. Off the left.
Hey, Mark Crispin Miller, who, like Rettenwald before, like Michael Rettenwald, former co-author with a book that I was writing with him.
Why don't we start there? So, Mark Crispin Miller has been the subject of a controversy at NYU. He has been tweeted about. There's an effort underway to get him fired, I guess, even though he's a tenured professor. He in some ways is similar to Michael Rechtenwald, who was also, Rechtenwald wasn't really threatened to be fired, but in fact got a tenure track position.
So he got a temporary, position that was guaranteed for a brief period of time. It's like temporary tenure, and he turned right during the review. It's also when he did his whole, anti-woke left Twitter thing that he got out of for. Ultimately, though, I don't think it ended up working out for him so well, even though it landed him on, he was one of the last guests of Bill O'Reilly, for example.
Rechtenwald was on what I think back in the day, it was actually Zero Books, the Zero Books podcast when he came on.
He was on Zero Books and SR twice, both before and after. It was SR became affiliated with Zero, so my old podcast. We were working on ideas of secularization on the left. I was doing an interview book with him. There was, I think, literally like 5 hours of recordings that I was transcribing and editing, and then. He did a piece for American Conservative. Was actually that piece was not what broke it off. And then he had his Bill O'Reilly, tour right-wing media. And then he wrote Springtime for Snowflakes, which was his like FU to the left book. Some of his Lauren Goldner's publication, which was a left communist publication, like changed the name of some of his articles, and there was a threat of lawsuits, and he and I quit talking over that period. Not even because I personally had a problem with him. He just seemed to be going pretty litigious, and it felt like things were not like principled, ordo liberalism anymore. It felt like it was going in a particular direction. And
Was someone who had some cachet on the left.
Yeah, I mean, he was my chosen successor at North Star.
Oh, really? He was the editor of North Star for a little while.
Very little while, but yeah, he wrote one of the pieces defending Mark Fisher from a left communist perspective. And when I stepped down and left the publication entirely and left it in the hands of Dario C, I don't know if he wants his last name added. They asked me, who would I have replaced me? And I gave them a list of five people, and Rettenwald was one of them. And Rettenwald, for a little while, took the position. He didn't stay on very long. I mean, he left before his right wing term, but yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's an interesting series of events to kind of consider the history of the North Star and then think about what's going on today. And the way that the essay Exiting the Vampire Castle by Mark Fisher has been treated and taken up and transformed and used since then. It became the leading essay for a certain social democratic movement. Like I would say the dirty leftists or the
dirtbag left. I think Class Unity Caucus really was inspired by it. I mean, but there's also this sort of like quote unquote post left, and I put that in quotations because that the meaning of that term has really changed.
Yeah, the post left of the 90s or the
90s and the aughts is like a completely different beast than the quote unquote post left now, which is really kind of, I mean, it's the Bellows, it's Angela Nagel, it's Red Scare podcast itself, it's people who ostensibly have left-wing politics, but if you were to map out their positions, they're actually somewhat closer to the center of the Republican Party. And I know people will get mad at me for saying that, but you know, it's very much what I see as a trend there. And what's hard though with some of the quote unquote post left, not so much with Nagel, but is that some of it's trolling. Some of it's not sincere. Some of it's just exploring ideas in a contrarian manner. And theoretically, I don't even have a problem with that. In fact, in some ways, if you're sincere about dealing with contrary opinions, it's actually something worthwhile doing. But it's one of the things. It's like there's a plausible deniability on what when these people interview someone, if they're advocating for them or not. I mean, if you talk about Miller for a second on the most recent Red Scare podcast, do you think that the Red Scare crew really pushed back on him at all?
No, I didn't. But you know, that I don't think of Red Scare as actually having an ideological position.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, okay, maybe that's not even exactly accurate, but I just don't have that expectation from the Red Scare. I wouldn't put them in the same category as the Bellows exactly. But I haven't listened to them a lot. You know, I've only listened to them occasionally. Well, the last one I listened to before this was Bannon, and yeah, they did push back on Bannon. But I
don't know. I don't want to like come down on them one way or the other. Actually, it's just interesting to me that there's this sense in which you hear people claim now, for example, that media is not political, right? I mean, our friend Matt Chrisman will say this all the time. But there is a way in which that is a constant veil of plausible deniability on like exploring some of these things. Yeah, well, let's go back to Chrisman Miller for a second.
Okay.
I'm of a lot of different minds about how to handle those kinds of scenarios. And what do I mean by those kinds of scenarios? Left-wing conspiracy thinking, which is very right-wing conspiracy adjacent, like it is.
The thing about Chrisman Miller is there's two tracks with him. One mm-hmm. is he's being targeted and censored by the university. There is an attempt to cancel him for things that he said in class. It's in the context of a censorious moment, one in which big tech companies really are clamping down. Our own channel is mm-hmm. suffering under the removal of a video. I think our views have dropped in conjunction with that. I don't think it's only because I've been putting fewer videos out, although that's part of it. But, you know, there is a moment here where around two major issues, the election and COVID health regulations or advice from the CDC, there's a tendency to be very authoritarian in what can be presented and on these big tech platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. I tend to side with like the Glenn Greenwald, Matt Taibbi, free speech advocate types on that issue. And then there's right. what Chrisman Miller actually says and how he blends the issue of corporate censorship and let's call it rad lib groupthink in with a bunch of propositions which can't be really supported, like that it's clear that the 2020 election was stolen from Trump, or that masks are disputed a health measure, or
that or his general anti-vax stuff that's been pushing for about 3 or 4 years now.
Right. All that stuff I thoroughly oppose, and I've been relatively open to like looking at the evidence around the election fraud, for instance. Right.
Right. You more than me, but Yeah.
Yeah. I've been open to it because I want to be consistent. I want to take things seriously. And what I found is every time I take a close look at any evidence presented, it falls apart. There really isn't a lot of good evidence for voter fraud. There's only the very best you have are moments that you can insinuate or interpret as nefarious, but you don't have any hard evidence of voter fraud. You have some disputable decisions that were made, and you might question the leniency around signature verification, say for mail-in balloting. But that's not clear that there's been a major change on that front. And so I would say, you know, that the people who take the allegations of voter fraud in the last election really seriously are not being they're being biased in their approach to the material, that there really isn't a lot of substantial evidence for that at all. And, you know, when it comes to masks, to me, that's a non-starter. Of course, masks have some effect, and it's better to wear one than not for most people. And the vaccine, you know, I think the thing that you might question about the vaccine is its efficacy and the kind of claims that can be made around its efficacy, because I've heard many things about how fast COVID mutates and how unsure people are about the trajectory of the virus. And so we may not be out of the woods with a vaccine, but I still think it's much better to have one. But, you know, these are my opinions, and I think if I had Mark Crispin Miller on the podcast or on this live stream like this one, I would debate those topics with him. But I don't think that what he's saying is beyond the pale of what should be accepted in public forums, and I don't think he should have his tenure revoked or be fired for having his.
Yeah, I mean, on one hand, I'm totally with you. On another hand, I somewhat get tired of tenured profs being treated as a special martyr category, given what it takes to get tenure and the kinds of labor aristocratic positions it gives you. I know I should be sympathetic for terms of discussion of ideas and academic freedom, and in that sense, I am. Mm-hmm. But in another category, I'm like, yeah, well, nobody else gets that. Like, I mean, I, as a teacher, which is a high school teacher, can get fired for all kinds of political things that I would even vaguely accidentally imply.
Yeah.
And that is with tenure protections, if I have them.
And the obvious thing to say to that is that you should have the protections that a tenure professor has.
Right. I mean,
rather than to take away the protections that the tenured professor.
Exactly.
That's even true. But I think that my instinct is that's true, that a high school teacher should have something like those protections.
Well, I mean, in one hand, I'm somewhat sympathetic to the fact that my students are captive, don't have another choice. Their parents are somewhat captive. So I should limit what I will speak and not speak about. I mean, I mean, even like, you know, as a public policy measure. On another hand, it is really easy to be accused of holding a position. And you know, this has been my response to a lot of people who talk about right-wing, you know, the right-wing support for freedom of speech is how thin it is. Because I have never been accused in my life by a liberal, even when I've said things that would offend normal liberals, of trying to subvert their children in a way that should get them fired. I have oft been accused for teaching standard curriculum of trying to do it with conservative parents.
I want to put a comment up on the screen here. Uh-huh. Can you read this?
I don't read Russian.
Yeah, I can't tell. What's something we got?
I hope that's Russian.
Yeah,
could be Ukrainian.
But we've got people talking about us in language that neither of us read, which for me would be any language other than English.
But, yeah, I read a lot of them, but Cyrillic is not Cyrillic based languages are not in my language categories.
But okay, so I also want to interject here and say the topic that I put forward, like in the description and the thumbnail, was that this is about 2020 and the end of 2020, and will the crises that define 2020 continue into 2021? I actually want to go backwards. I almost said continue into 2019, which I
the direction. Well, go like back into the past, and
But I think that Mark Crispin Miller, I mean, I think we should both like assert a justification for talking about him and talking about this particular topic. I think he is symptomatic of this moment in a way that might help us define what we're up against in 2021. Like that he's not just a blip, but he represents sort of a culmination of tendencies, especially on the left.
Well, there, yeah. I mean, you and I are battling in some ways conspiracy thinking, because, you know, to put it in a very off the cuff, unrigorous way, our elites suck, and in lieu of that, it's very easy to like project all kinds of things on the seeming insanity of right now. I mean, like,
right.
But the thing is, for me, what I see in someone like Miller is that in this seeming inability for anyone to take control of this current stasis, and like I've used this term a couple times, and I don't mean things staying the same. I mean social forces in a polity canceling each other out so that like no one is actually able to guide or control anything. So stasis here is a point of social conflict where things spin out of control because no one can assert dominance and there's not really anyone in charge. And when that happens, and it's happened before, but it's really bad right now. I mean, I think it's like world historically bad. Mm-hmm. Like that might seem like an overclaim, but like, I don't think we've seen anything this bad since the beginning of the 20th century. Where there's going to be a certain amount of calls for conspiracy narrative. I mean, one of the things that we have to accept is like, as much as I may feel that, you know, what Mark Crispin Miller has said, some of the stuff he said has been more popular on the left in different time periods that like basically younger millennial and Zoomer leftists don't remember. You know, I remember anti-vax stuff being a more left-wing thing in the aughts. I remember, particularly in the West, in the coastal West. I remember that's not true anymore, but I remember when it was. I remember 9/11 trueferism being like Alex Jones and then a bunch of leftists. Like it was not that big of a right-wing conspiracy. And Mark Crispin Miller has been involved in that for a long time. Like this is not new. You know,
he's got $1,000 in Hungarian forint, so a thousand of those. So I want to flash that on the screen and tell this person that we will address the possibility of a permanent pandemic, in a moment.
Okay. Go ahead. So I think in that scenario, what do you do with that? Like, so I think we've seen even on the far left, even on the revolutionary left, not just in the liberal left, I'm not just talking about Russiagate anymore. The tendency to believe in conspiracy theories or to take things that are true. The OSS, for example, messed with left-wing activists and to turn them into like full blown explanations for failures of the left or this, that, and the other.
Yeah. That's been a longstanding problem on the left.
Right.
I mean, it goes back to the Vietnam War, at least, you know, COINTELPRO.
It goes back to the 30s. Actually, Christopher Lash talks about it coming up in the failure of the populist movement in the 19 teens. Like it's when we fail and we don't have any other mechanism, we often turn to conspiracy theories because it does two things. It removes our ability. It removes our responsibility for failure because we couldn't have done anything else. And it also means that someone's still in control, that like, this isn't the chaos of the capitalist system or just the chaos of the world. Even like, this is something that is controllable. And like, I used to have rules for like the viability of conspiracies. And one of them is like, if it involves more than 50 people, it's not possible to keep secret. You know, like there are real conspiracies, but they have to be somewhat small and limited. And another thing that historically speaking, they tend to be more than covering people's asses and actually like perpetuating worldwide schemes. And yet we are stuck in this area where if like former bourgeois liberties are to mean anything. And I guess one thing that we have to say is there's been this total turn to short-term practical instrumental reasoning on the left, where they think, oh, we're going to benefit from getting rid of this right winger. We're going to benefit from this, that, or the other. But we're going to use bourgeois power structures to do that. That aren't even governmental, that are at private fiat, you know, and not realize how likely that is to backfire on us. And I've just been told by people that that doesn't matter anymore. Because, I mean, one of the things that you can see from...
Why do they say that it doesn't matter?
Because the quote unquote threat of the right wing overrides any possible damage. And that we shouldn't believe
even right now when Biden's about to take office, the threat of the right wing overrides the damage.
Well, we already see that. Like, I'm already, Biden's about to take office and you see people doubling down on defense of the Biden administration because of its diversification, and diversification is a long process and you have to go conservative before you go left with it, et cetera, and so forth. You know, I mean, when I point out that this was actually the structural logic of the Bush, of George W. Bush's administration and its own diversification push, which, you know, it had, like,
right.
And in some ways, actually more so than Obama did, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. Why is there such that used as such an excuse? And I guess maybe because, because you have to grasp onto something and it's some kind of power node. But, you know, it doesn't seem to me that like this is like a woke conspiracy as much as like people trying to figure out how to maintain very short instrumental power. I mean, like Biden doesn't seem to be operating from a point of strength anywhere.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't think that the far right or the Trump right is really in a strong position either right now. I don't think anyone's in a very strong
position. No, I don't. Right now. I don't think. Well, that's my point. Like, I actually think, like, to me, that the Trump, that 30% of the Republicans are in the same spot as Alex Jones does not indicate that worldview is strong. It indicates that things are pretty bad. Like that there isn't any, that no one's operating from a position of power. I mean, in some ways, it's not just that the emperor has no clothes, the entire kingdom has no clothes, and no one really wants to point it out.
Well, back to Mark Crispin Miller and how we should respond to this. I mean, it's clear to me that a certain kind of opposition to corporate elites and to big business and to a certain rad lib mindset or wokeism, that all of that cannot be just thrown aside by serious Marxists. We can't just like take the opposite point of view and embrace those things, right? We can't just say, oh yeah, we're pro-corporate. And although I'm often tempted to say that I'm for the consolidation of big capital and against small business, because we'll bring the proletariat together into one bigger institutions and give them more of an ability to organize. That's really not proven out by any empirical data. It's just something,
right?
And in a contrarian way, I like to say, it's like, you know, screw the mom and pop shop. Let's all be working for our big monopolies. And there's some logic to it, but I don't know if it's empirically right. But we certainly can't just embrace the Democratic Party or kind of the worst of wokeism, but we can't simply define ourselves as pro small business, anti woke.
Yeah, I know. I
mean, that's craziness. So, but we seem to be stuck in this, and have been for a while stuck in this dilemma, this kind of a false dilemma. And I think the way that Mark Crispin Miller is being framed is that you either side with the censorship of him and his ejection from the university, or you become Michael Rechtenwald. Like, right. And, or you are seen as at least empowering him, someone like Rechtenwald. And I don't think that's right. I also don't think Crispin Miller is quite the same as Rechtenwald.
I think it's a different time period for one thing. I mean,
that's the big difference. That is it. Like, Rechtenwald made a decision right after Trump got elected to do the things that he was doing and to publish the kind of book he was publishing. And it's just a different kettle of fish for Crispin Miller to do something similar, claiming to still be a leftist. And when Biden takes office, it just has.
I mean, one of the things with Mark Crispin Miller is also there's a clearer trajectory, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could say that Michael Rechtenwald was always anti-woke, and to some degree that was somewhat true. I mean, you know, again, his defense with Jody Dean.
I remember seeing him on Fox News being fairly woke.
Well, so he had three phases. Like, he had a normal kind of liberal professor phase. Then he turned to left communism, and then he turned against that. First, defending himself as a classical liberal. I don't know what he calls himself now. I mean, I have read his Springtime for Snowflakes. It seems like normal Jordan Peterson style, like actually to the right of Jordan Peterson, just straight up, you know, normal almost neoconservative style republicanism. And what I find interesting is we're going to be stuck in a bind for a while. And this bind is a very, okay. So on one side, you seem to have it to maintain any consistent left position. You have to maintain some kind of allegiance with the mainstream of the Democrats. And you and I know that in a long-term trajectory, that's historically speaking, when people talk about that being our only aim, the only time they have for anything like that working is the 1930s. And even in that scenario, they have to bracket out the fact we don't have a labor movement like we did then. They have to bracket out that the populist and progressive, I mean, not pop, the progressive party too, but the populist and the socialist do not exist in the same scale. I mean, like, in the 19 teens, the socialist movement was four times what it is right now, in a time where the U.S. population was like one fifth of what it is right now. I mean, like, so when you scale that up, it's a massive difference. I mean, socialist and populist, depending on where you were at, actually got controls of cities and legislatures. Not one or two city council people are a judge. Mm-hmm. And I realize that since the 60s, it has been so rare for leftists to have any wins that we think that this is big. But the other thing that I find fascinating is if you track out the kind of the progressive movement within the Democratic Party from McGovern forward, it's not that much bigger. It's just, this is the first time it would call itself socialist. Mm-hmm. I mean, like the Dennis Kucinich, like Mike Gravel, I mean, you know, whatever Gravel is now, like that portion of the party has been
a couple of teenagers now, I understand.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
But that portion of the party has been fairly consistent. And like when I first turned back left, I was interested in that. I thought that was gonna be our way forward. And watching people get so blackpilled off of it not working, when I'm like, but we've tried. Like, even when I went into this in 2006, 2007, and felt like we could bring socialist ideas to the most marginal wing of the Democratic Party at the time, because the DSA, people forget this, but the DSA back then had been moribund for 30 years. I was going to see something, and I didn't see anything. That Gravel was chased out of the party into the Libertarian Party for a while. I mean, like...
Let's steer this back to the Crispin Miller, if we can. I mean, like, okay, so there's a tendency to want to embrace the center or the Democratic Party overall, and that would mean supporting the censorship of Crispin Miller.
Yeah,
would it? Yeah,
I mean, well, at least right now it would. Yeah. I mean,
which is weird that it would mean that in a way, because the Democratic Party has been aligned with like organizations like the ACLU.
But the ACLU has even deprioritized defending free speech.
I know that's. What are they then? What the fuck are they for? I'm sorry, I shouldn't swear on my live stream, but what are they for if not the defensive?
I mean, they still defend it, but like they now have a prioritization about when you defend free speech and when you are less likely to, or you divert fewer and fewer resources to it. I mean, and they do that off of quote unquote social justice pressures. You know,
right? Which comes down, and the thing about social justice pressures that we should recognize is that it comes down to a progressivist, statist agenda. It's not so much that you're concerned about, let's say, racism as a general issue that makes you on the side of social justice, but that you might be willing to give up free speech in order to counter hate speech. That
right.
Makes you, a progressive social justice.
Or you might pick up positions held by libertarians that fighting for free speech in non-governmental areas or tangential governmental areas, such as academic institutions, is no longer really a high priority. Not that you won't do it at all, but that, and I think the ACLU would not say they would not defend someone like Mark Crispinero's free speech if it was, you know, but it's going to be a very, very low resource priority. And they have less resources than they used to. I mean, one of the things I was telling people here is when we did immigration activism, and I'm going to out some stuff. I don't normally talk about the activism I do in real life on the pod, but we did immigration activism, we being me and some friends and my partner. We actually had to go to the ACLU of Wyoming as opposed to the ACLU of Utah, because the ACLU of Utah had taken private donations, not from a company that was a private prison runner, but from an individual who owned that company. And so to get support, we had to go to a different state's ACLU. Well, that ACLU had one lawyer on staff in Wyoming. They are severely understaffed. But that also tells you that, like, even within the ACLU, the national org is actually quite, like, it's actually not particularly consistent. It actually operates from state to state on how it works. And there are some guidelines on how they're going to prioritize resources, but they don't have a lot of resources either. And they need increased NGO style and corporate funding. They just do. And that's driving a lot of their decisions. Right. I mean, they've seen declines. You know, millennials and, you know, people under 40 don't tend to join and thus aren't dues paying members. And that's true for a lot of these organizations. You know, whatever you want to say about the NGO statuses and the problems that they have, without large membership bases, their only source of funding is corporate. And so considering that, like, you have an HR style mentality, which is based largely on preventing lawsuits, which is where a lot of this particular pernicious forms of these ideas have really developed, is not out of even the left. It's out of left ideas interpreted by HR firms and then resold back to universities. But I think there has been a bad faith and somewhat right wing, I mean, and if I am completely honest, attempt to use that to discredit anything anything in woke ideology that might be worth fighting for, you know, like. And so we're kind of
an example of something in woke ideology that you think is worth.
Well, I mean, I think dealing with structural racism is important. Like, and I do think it's real. Like, I think it is largely a function of class, but that class is manifest in racialized ways. And like,
well, I don't know what structural racism is if it isn't attached to wealth and distribution and class issues.
Exactly. It doesn't mean anything. I mean, you do have cultural capital issues and social capital issues, like, that I think are real, but you can't disaggregate them.
You can't address cultural capital disparities
without addressing capital disparities. Right.
I mean, you've got to start with capital disparities, and you certainly don't want to, if you're worried about getting rid of people's cultural capital through cancel campaigns, then, you know, that's the way to address disparities in cultural capital, then I think you're out to lunch and you're going to make a mess of
your I mean, the thing about cancel campaigns is they can ruin your life if you're in certain industries,
mm-hmm.
you know, but like, if, okay. So yes, if I got truly canceled, it could hurt us at zero, mm-hmm. but it would not affect my income. But there are there are people largely in academia. Your income a lot. But if you canceled someone in media or in higher education, it does have a lot more effect. Yeah. But
who has cultural capital? People in media and higher education who are or the culture industry in general. I mean, you don't have cultural capital in other venues, do you?
I mean, you kind of do, but
like, you're talking about like nepotism or getting hired for jobs.
Well, also, like I'm going to go off all culture industry. Like the people who set the terms of the culture industry are much more resistant to canceling than their products. If you think about the Weinstein,
people actually own the companies,
right? The Weinsteins are like one of the few
capital, though. That's financial capital.
But they have more cultural capital than financial capital. Like the Weinsteins' power was not just financial; it was cultural. It was to act as a cultural gatekeeper, and that's I mentioned them because that's one of the few times I can think of where they actually went after the capital owner and not the capital product in a cultural capital scenario. Mm-hmm. And you know, like this issue is not really addressed. We don't, and I'm going to be honest with you. There's very little incentive to address it on the left. And you and I both know why. And it doesn't have to do with cultural capital. Even it doesn't have to do with woke or anti-woke posturing. It has to do with who owns our stocks.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's certain things you can't go after. I mean, you know, and so
like name one that you can't go after, even though this isn't the Parrot Room. Let's go out on a limb on New Year's Eve. And what can't we go after?
If I was Verso, could I go after Penguin Publishing Group in a real way?
Probably not. No,
no, I cannot.
We can go after anyone we want.
With the exception of Dunhop Publishing.
Right.
I mean, luckily we're owned by someone who doesn't really matter in the broader scheme of things. And I don't say that as an insult to John Hunt Publishing. It's just we're a niche publication.
Crystal Healing is bunk.
Well, yeah.
Don't buy books about Crystal Healing. And I'm not going to get fired from John Hunt Publishing for saying that, even though they published a few books on that subject.
Right. Well, I mean, you could go after a specific thing. Like you can make a big deal out of certain things within the spectrum of even, let's say I was Verso and I wanted to write something against another Penguin author. That's going to be fine. That might even help the other Penguin author. That's the other part of this, right? So like canceling Mark Crispin Miller is probably in some ways in the short run, one of the better things for his career.
Oh, for him. Yeah. And it also helps. It really actually helps like the QAnon types too, and the anti-maskers and the anti-vaxxers for them to go after.
Well, that's one thing we can learn this year, right? The more people attacked on purely political grounds, anti-maskers, the more it became a culture war. Now, I realize the problem with this because I want to support sound science, but attacking someone's belief is not giving them an alternative belief and policy set to attach to, even if that policy set is part of the status quo. And so that tends to put people and it puts you in a weird scenario where you become part of the very feedback loop you're trying to fight against.
Let's go back to this question here that we were paid, I think in US dollars, around $4 for. What do you think about the possibility of a permanent pandemic, a new COVID variants, new viruses, lockdowns, curfews, poverty level, UBI, if any? The question, another way to frame that question would be, what will happen to U.S. politics and left politics generally after COVID, or is COVID not going to go away because of the reasons that the
question. Well, I think we're going to have increased. I think there is the truth that climate change and the climate science is going to lead to increased pandemics. And I think the weird side of that is because people's inability to deal with something that large and that out of their control, you're going to see more and more conspiracy and you know, reactive tendencies to that. I say reactive, not reactionary, because like I don't think it's going to be a simple political calculus. Do I think that we're going to have a permanent? I mean, I don't. In some ways, I think some things have changed in ways that are not going to be undone. I'm not sure what is or what isn't. But I can tell you, for example, that even with the vaccines, mask wearing isn't going to go away immediately, because it's going to take a while for even if everything about the vaccines is perfectly as stated, it's going to take about a year for enough people to have immunity for us not to be potential spreaders, given the kind of vaccine this is.
Urban people will be wearing masks if they're at all sick, just like people in China and Japan and Asia.
Yeah, I mean, frankly, we should have been doing it for the flu for a while. But yeah, that's my personal. That was my personal opinion 10 years ago before COVID.
Right.
Ever since I lived in Korea, I've thought, why don't we wear masks during flu season when you have the flu? Like, it just makes it easier. And I thought, what I thought was interesting is I thought.
We got another question. What do you think of fire? They said in June there was more applications for help than any June before.
I'm familiar with fire. I think that they lean slightly right wing, but I kind of do like them. I think they're necessary. One of the things I will say, if you look at their statistics, it is interesting where you have these problems. It is fairly elite institutions where you have a lot of what we would consider liberal censorship causes, but they actually end up sticking up for a lot of liberals and more conservative areas where, like, you know, I've known people to have like PragerU style bait and switches on liberal professors to get them fired. And often if they're not tenure tracked, they do get them fired. Like I have had friends who have been fired for making an offhand comment, not technically for what they said, but for creating a hostile environment for the student, quote unquote.
So someone says that we should take sacred mushrooms and lose the fear of death. And like, I'm down with that. That's what I'm going to do later tonight. Someone else says Venn diagram, Joe Rogan, Dasha and Anna, and Douglas Lane. So there's some crossover, I guess, there. I would like to see what's in the places of contact. All right, I'm sorry. I'm going to comments, but let's talk just so.
So what do you mean? Like my point with Chris Miller is we're going to be in a bind. We should. I do think we should be defending his freedom of speech. I don't really, however, care. Like, I don't want to defend what he says. I think we should attack a lot of it ruthlessly. I think
that's how we should defend it, because, you know, in a context of where the videos are being taken down and. You can't, I mean, look, if we did a video about Mark Crispin Miller defending mask wearing, say, there's a good chance it would get taken down.
Well, here's the thing though. I will be honest with you, because of the procedures in universities, Mark Crispin Miller probably will do better even under the complaint right now, if we're actually fair, is that they're investigating him without any formal accusations of what specifically he did to violate school policy. Right. That it's a very generic accusation. And it looks like the investigation is basically just to show due diligence to the people complaining. On one hand, that is actually different than what's happening to us with these big mega corporations.
Yeah.
However, I don't want to say it's too different.
Are worse, you know?
Huh? Yeah. I mean, because we don't have any recourse.
Like, yeah. We don't. I mean, I'm still trying to get YouTube's attention. I mean, I've sort of backed down a little bit, not really on purpose, but I might be going on Cumtown to talk about it. That will get their attention.
But I've seen people, not you, but I've seen people get tweets pulled that they can't even figure out how the tweet could. And if you don't have anyone bully pulpiting for you, you can't get through their mediators. You just can't. And I, you know, like, and yet I do see people say things on Twitter and on right wing and left wing, frankly, that totally clearly violate policies with no background whatsoever. I mean, like, they just don't notice it. They don't care. And I don't want those people censored, by the way. I'm just saying, like, it is arbitrary and capricious sometimes how this works. Saying anything about COVID has changed it. I will admit now that the warnings on Facebook have gotten ridiculous, where, like, I get a warning for sharing totally vetted peer-reviewed science if it has COVID in the title at all, because they don't want to deal with, the algorithm doesn't want to deal with legitimacy issues.
Someone asked, did Mark Crispin Miller do something new, or is this the October one? And you know what? I don't know what happened in October, but we should have said at the outset what Mark Crispin Miller was accused of. He was accused of, and maybe we did say it, but I'll repeat it. He was accused of telling his class that they shouldn't wear masks, and that the campaign around mask wearing was propaganda. And then after that, after a student complained about that, on Twitter, in a long stream of tweets, then there was a letter written by his colleague saying that he was a hateful bigot, or because of some comments he may have made about Sandy Hook, which he actually says he didn't make, and which I believe actually that he didn't make them, and also about transgender people, which I've never heard anything concrete about what he might have said.
I've never heard him talk about. That doesn't seem to be normally in his pet issues. It's normally like,
no, I just thought that he said much.
It seems like he got lumped in with Alex Jones, like without proof. Like they basically took his conspiracy positions and someone like Alex Jones and his conspiracy positions and said they were one-to-one.
And apparently there was some scientific studies that he cited in his class that were, you know, peer reviewed and random double blind studies or whatever that showed that there was some question about the efficacy of mask wearing for respiratory diseases.
Yeah, well, those do exist. I mean, and a lot of it is the efficacy on self-protection, not the efficacy of protection of others.
Well, right, but I mean, like, that's completely different. I mean, yeah, that's not a surprise.
I've looked at some of those because my brother who's a physical therapist was briefly interested in that stuff because he's kind of conservative, and he eventually just said no, that the evidence isn't with it, wear a mask, but I mean, you know, he did look at it, and he did have some actual papers. So I mean,
like, it's, to me, it's not even really, why bother worrying about it? It's clear enough that masks help spread some germs,
help prevent the spread of some.
I mean, help prevent the spread. Sorry. Help prevent the spread of some germs. And you know, it may not be perfect, but it, you know, there's a reason why Hawkeye wore a mask in the surgery room in MASH. That's all I'll say. Right.
Right. I mean, it's not perfect. Clearly, if it was perfect, we would have less cases than we do. And there are things about this virus that I think we can fairly easily say, even though I want to give the scientific community some props that I don't normally give the scientific community, but like, we have figured more out about this virus in a faster time than most viruses we do in 10 years. And yet I still say, we probably don't know that much about it. Like, yeah, it's so new
fast. And I do think that you should not, you know, exclusively give credit to Trump for it, but it is true that the Trump administration spent a lot of money to get the vaccine. There was a heroic effort across the board to get a vaccine, and it was really, really fast, because at the beginning of the pandemic, the word was, in normally it would take about 4 years.
Right. I mean, to be fair, it was across the board in every country that had the capacity to do so, but like, it wasn't just us, but yes.
It was just America, Derek. Mm-hmm. We are number one. I just want to point that we are, the UK is, Russia is. There are a few other places that are number one, but we are number one.
I mean, yeah, go ahead.
So I don't know. You know, it's been about 50 minutes. Why don't we take a couple more questions from people? Now that we talked about Mark Crispin Miller for this entire time and sort of all over the map. And by the way, I'm two beers in on New Year's Eve. So maybe this wasn't the best. I've been enjoying the conversation. I'm not sure if it's the most structured conversation we've ever
had. No, I mean, we're structured when we talk about history. I knew that when we were doing the interview. I do think Mark Crispin Miller and the Jimmy Dore AOC fights, actually, to bring up something else that's a hot topic right now.
We should talk about that in the next.
Right.
The
Well, to me, they indicate not just one bad side, but like how we've gotten to the point where almost all popular opinions amongst the left, regardless, if you pick a side in some of these battles and you pick it unilaterally, like you pick one side clearly across the board, and a lot of these popular left debates or whatever on Twitter, I think one, you're going to take a position that in 3 or 4 months you're going to regret. Like and two, I think people thought that we've moved left wing in the last 4 years, and this entire time I've been whispering sometimes and yelling others. No, we haven't. Like, we have been moving the left rightward so that it is more popular, but like, we haven't really been shifting the Overton window as much as it seems like we have, other than changing the popularity of the S word amongst a bunch of poor socialists.
Someone says, Doug's been hanging out with Catrone too often. I wonder what I was saying in that moment that made them post that. But why don't we talk about the Catrone interviews? Did you see those?
I watched them on your suggestion. I thought that they were interesting in that Catrone has posited, for example, that maybe the modes of capitalism have shifted from late LTV to marginalism. And I mean,
marginal utility.
Yeah. Derek.
The last Marxist, is Milton Friedman, I guess. I mean, I don't know what that even means that you would say. I think he kind of backed out of that position during the interview.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is about, I want to give Chris credit before, you know, like Chris, a lot of times is thinking on his feet and trying to work things out. He has a way of speaking that is hyper authoritative. And often, like, he probably hasn't worked everything out when he's saying that, because when you push him on things, he'll often give you a better, more thought out answer than you'd, you know, and not one that is stereotypically Republican or whatever the people think they are, that you would think. But yet there are still times where it's like, are you really positing that everything that currently is, I mean, like, The consensus reality view is actually much more true than what Marxists historically would say. I mean, I don't know. I think
he gets away with, I mean, I like Catrone, actually.
I know you do.
But I think he gets away with making assertions about the economic system, say, that wouldn't pass the muster if he wasn't so playful,
right?
And how he approaches things, and quite skilled as a rhetorician.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a historiographer, and I've used that term not a historian, as a historiographer of the left, Catrone has some interesting things to deal with. I don't agree with most of them at this point in my life, but I will say that both going through the Frankfurt School and then not Frankfurt School, haha. That's what I'm just reading right now. Going through Platypus, which was my attempt to apply the Frankfurt School to some actual politics, not just academic work, was very good for me. Even if I ultimately, like, not just left, but left with not bitterness towards a group, but a profound disagreement with a lot of their ideas. But, you know, I also went through more conventional left groups and had profound disagreement with their ideas, and they weren't always as productive.
No, I think that's the thing about Platypus. If anything is still good about them, is that they are productive. And I will say that is how you should approach Red Scare and Mark Crispin Miller and Angela Nagel and all of the post-leftists. Is like, okay, you don't have to agree with these people. They may not really define the what the left is very well. They may have gone off the rails and to the right, but they say they're on the left. Figure out why they can still say that and overcome what they're doing as best you can without resorting to gatekeeping.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a tendency to gatekeep that I understand why it exists. And I also think this is going to get worse, but no one's going to win. Like, I think what we're going to see in the next few years is you're going to see an intensification of gatekeeping, and not just from the quote unquote woke crowd. Mm-hmm. I think the anti-woke crowd, I'm using quotation marks for both so people can get mad at me, but they're both going to gatekeep more. There's going to be a lot more gatekeeping about those mutually constituted positions within the left itself, because neither one of them, frankly, have answers to everything that's going on right now. I mean, one of the big questions that, you know, I think we still haven't dealt with on the left, and you and I have been talking about this nigh on 8 years. This came up in Pop the Left Round One, that that there is a truth to the fact that the proletariat wage relationship, if you include the service sector, and almost everyone who has a brain in Web Capital Volume 2 does, is about 80% of the population at minimum, and probably upwards of 90. Even if you exclude people who technically draw a salary but make more money from stock options or from investments or whatever, that this universalization has seen stratas seem to matter more than the class itself. And I don't think we've dealt with what that is, other than to posit these other classes that I think, you know, my favorite is to talk about the PMC. I think there's a sociological truth to the PMC thesis. I do. But that's not the same as saying there's an economic truth to the PMC thesis, that they make up a coherent economic class with coherent singular interests, because I don't think they do. But I think rejecting what that's trying to illustrate, that sociological truth is wrongheaded. I mean, really wrongheaded. But we have to go back to our Marxist class analysis and start from there, not from ad hoc empirical observations. I mean, I think the empirical stuff is important. You have to adjust stuff to empirical data. Otherwise, we're just a religion, right? I mean mm-hmm. that seriously. But you either have to say the Marxist framework doesn't work, or you have to say there's something in this framework we have not understood and we need to work out better among consistent lines. Because trying to ad hoc it, trying to maintain Marxism, but throwing in some like random exceptions and unclear things because they seem empirically true, seems to me to make a hash out of Marxism to where it means whatever the hell we want it to mean. And right now, like, I'm not a Marxist purist. People will hear me on the Theorizing the Hammer talk about that doesn't mean anything right now. There's nobody. I can't find someone who upholds all the same positions of Marx and Engels in, you know, but even by the end of their life. There's not a political group that really does that. Even the left communists innovate. They do. Like, decadence theory.
We have to do a future episode on the innovation of left communism, or left communist innovation.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think like the invariant program kind of freezes things in 1935. But like,
I want to flash the last comment on the screen, and I think we should walk out here. Yeah, 58 minutes and 30 seconds. So this is the last thought of 2020. Joe Rogan is king of the normies. He is a beacon to everyday centrism. I just thought that was a great
point. I mean, I think, you know what? I think that's true. But you know what that tells you about centrism and normiedom? That normiedom's being proletarianized. And even the rich are trashy now. And I mean, I say that, like, and it sounds like I'm making a moral judgment, but I'm actually saying, like, everything is somehow in an area where nobody can establish traditional modes of credibility. Something has happened in capitalism in America, and I think in the West in general, that makes that almost impossible. And if you see people try to appeal to a normal moral center with legitimacy and all that, you're going to actually see it out of quote unquote non-capitalist in quotation societies. And like, in China and in Russia and in those areas. I don't think you're going to see it here.
Well, I just want to praise Joe Rogan enough that I get on his show.
Well, if you get on his show, more power to you.
Yeah. And I'm going to close with the branded video. And then in about 10 minutes, we'll jump on to the Parrot Room.